Now it's 6 a.m. California time. If you're not a morning person, you need to compensate for it. So Perry brewed me a cup of coffee that I could chew. And so if I start shaking during the caffeine overdose, we can turn on the overhead here. I'm going to give you a lot of my notes on the overhead so you can follow along with things. Basically, in about an hour to discuss this topic is going to, be overwhelming. So I'm going to try to give us an overview of the approach and the major features that science helps us in defending the Christian faith. As an overview, we really have to realize that we are living in a scientific age. And to have a credible testimony for Christianity, we have to be interacting with the worldview, not necessarily, every scientist, all the scientists. There's not that many scientists out there, but the worldview is the scientific one. So we need to, first of all, in our approach, really aim to show that the Bible is compatible with the scientific worldview. And by that, we're not meaning that it's the physics textbook that will find Newton's laws in there and so on. But when the Bible does broach in an area that science has done work in, we would expect the scriptures to be accurate. And in some cases, and I have some examples of this that we'll look at, that we see in the scriptures an accuracy of science that's could not be deduced from contemporary culture, that the pre-knowledge of science that we find there is quite different than ancient beliefs were at the time that the scriptures were written. Second thing that we need to show is that not only is the Bible compatible, but that it's unique among contemporary thought at the time the scriptures were written. It's also unique among other religious writings of the time period in having this correct worldview. And this gives us then a real apologetic advantage in working with people when we can say there's something here unique in the scriptures that we don't find in any other ancient writings. What's the reason for that? Well, perhaps that's because there's a God who's involved as the author. So, in order to see this second point, that the scriptures have this unique element to them, it's very important that we contrast scientific statements in the Bible with that we find in other writings from the period and in other worldviews from the period. Very important in science to be doing a control. In other words, when you do an experiment and you mix some things in a test tube and you get some results, well, those results are very handy, but you need to compare those with what you would get if you mixed the reactants in a slightly different combination. So part of the uniqueness of the scriptures, then, we get by comparing it to the contemporary things. The key difference that I'll be pointing out is the transcendence of God that we see in the scriptures, as opposed to the animism or pantheism that is really the dominant philosophy of how gods were viewed in the ancient times. Again, God is above nature. He's not a part of the natural world. He's created it, but he is not in it. That's the difference between the scriptural worldview that we see between God and nature and that it is in every other culture at the time that the Bible was written. Examples of this that we see that even carried into medieval times, for example, was the whole idea that the earth was a living being. The explanation for tides that we find, again, even up in the medieval times, is that tides show that the earth is breathing. Your chest expands and contracts as you breathe. If you imagine being a flea on a dog, you would see the dog move as it breathed. Well, because we see the water moving on the earth, not responsible, and that's not due to wind action or something, then that's showing that the earth is breathing, therefore the earth is alive. This type of logic being used to explain phenomena. Again, the earth, heavenly bodies, rocks, weather, all phenomena that were observed were assigned to the fact that this thing was alive, and usually that it was a god or there was a god living in it, to that event, and that explained what we observed. Nature, therefore, was viewed as being very capricious. These gods in the rocks, the gods in the earth from which we grew our crops, we really couldn't count on them and trust them. They had to be placated. We had to seek their favor when we did something. That whole mentality is common to the ancient Near East, to the culture of the time. The only way that we as people could get a handle or get any control over nature was through magic and ritual. We had to offer sacrifices to the earth gods. We would need to do various rituals or superstitious things in order to ward off various demons from attacking us and things to that regard. So again, it's an entirely different worldview than what we find in the scriptures from that standpoint. Natural phenomena that we would observe in the sky. And there was not a lot of differentiation made between weather and astronomical things. So a comet or a bad thunderstorm were kind of viewed in the same light. An eclipse, for example, was a very evil omen about the king dying or something to that effect, and not viewed as just a natural phenomenon that the sun is being blocked by the moon. These things just were not put together. So in light of, or in contrast to, the worldview around them, we see statements in the scriptures like this one here from Jeremiah, where Jeremiah tells the people, "Do not learn the ways of the nations or be terrified by the signs in the sky, though the nations are terrified by them, for the customs of the peoples are worthless." That's an incredible contrast between the worldview in Egypt, Babylon, Syria, wherever you would go in the ancient Near East, to that in Israel. Don't be thrown off by the fear and the terror and the lack of control that people feel over all the natural phenomena that they see. All their fear is directed in the wrong way. They're not worshiping me. They're not in contact with me. I'm above it all. So that is a key contrast, that when we're using science to back up Christianity, we need to keep in mind is, where is the scientific view in the scriptures coming from? It's coming from a vast contrast with that in the cultures around Israel. The final goal that we want to go for is that belief in the Bible is intellectually credible. The very common viewpoint expressed by the media and so on is that if you take religion at all seriously, if you're a real Christian, you basically have to put your brain on the shelf and not think critically about various issues or whatever. One goal in bringing science into the apologetic arena is that we want to show that it's intellectually credible to believe in the scriptures. Now, just an aside here, a lot of scientific issues are brought up by people to be smoke screens. In other words, you'll be witnessing to them and say, well, science has proven that the Bible's a bunch of garbage, it's just myth, and so on. And one approach I recommend to countering that argument is to try to focus on a specific problem that they bring up, rather than, you pick one that they don't really care about. But say, well, okay, if that's what you've heard or feel, what specific problem did you have in mind? To try to focus on, like Dr. Newman mentioned last night, one or two questions that are personally a roadblock or a stumbling block to them, and try to focus your attention on what's an issue to them in this area. Perhaps they've run across young Earth arguments that they can't buy because they're a geologist or something from that standpoint. And one question that my wife likes to ask people is, well, if they're throwing up objections, to say, well, what would it take to convince you that Christianity was true? And let them think through what positive evidence would they accept to, you know, in considering whether believing Christianity or not. So that's a, I think, an important thing to bring up. Rather than turn it into an intellectual debate about, well, you know, is this right or this right, to keep it poised in the positive, what would it take to convince you that Christianity were true? And then you can be addressing real concerns. And if they say nothing, well, then you can say, well, how rational are you being? You know, you can put them on the spot from that standpoint. So that's, I think, the overview of where we want to be going this morning. I want to just look at some problems that I've seen in approaches that people have taken to working with science and Bible issues. One of these is the area I just called sensationalism. We have a real strong tendency to grab the latest thing in the media and try to use it to our advantage or whatever. And this has been done in working with science and Bible issues as well. The way I would word it is we need to be careful not to read a pre-knowledge of science into a scriptural passage when the context doesn't really warrant it. And a couple of good examples of this are Genesis 10:25, where it's going through some genealogies and it says, in the days of Peleg, he got his name because in those days the earth was divided. And I've seen a lot of things where people say, aha, this is proof, scientific proof about the Bible, because continental drift is being mentioned here. The earth was divided, the continents were splitting. And the problem with that argument is that it doesn't fit any date for how you would date the origin of the earth or the age of the earth, because it doesn't fit the old earth models, because it's after the flood, and the earth would have had to separate during it, basically, to make it work better. It doesn't fit the young earth model because it's too recent as well. Doesn't fit either one because the dating is wrong. So that's one that people will take a phrase, see it fit a continental drift theory, and say, there's science in the Bible. So that's not that's the type of thing we need to avoid. Another example is Job 38:7, where God's describing creation. He says, at that time, the morning stars sang together, rejoicing in what he was doing. And I've seen some apologetic books that say, well, now we can hear that sound with radio telescopes, and that's proof then, you know, that the scriptures are scientifically accurate. What we have to watch out for is grabbing a phrase like that and running with it. While 38.7 is reasonable, there's a difference between the acoustic spectrum and the electromagnetic spectrum, and radio waves do not necessarily carry over into acoustic waves. If people said, well, that's proof of the solar wind or something, maybe that would work better. But again, you're getting a little far-fetched with some of these. And I guess the point is there's good evidence there. We don't want to weaken our credibility by grabbing thin limbs and walking out on those. So that's a danger we need to watch out for. Another problem in working with science and Bible issues is the area of poetic expression. Again, the Bible contains a very wide range of literary genre, from poetry to narrative to proverbs and so on. And we need to take that into account when we're translating the Bible, as well as, you know, drawing conclusions from it. And a big area we have to watch out for is metaphor, personification. We can draw something from it that's a personification that's not fully accurate. It's part of poetic license, if you will. Examples of that are Psalm 104, verse 3, where, again, it says that God makes the clouds his chariot. And someone could jump on that and say, well, again, you know, this is viewing God as a chariot rider in a very human form, riding clouds. And, you know, we know God doesn't do that, therefore, you know, conclude some vastly negative thing. Again, I would just view as okay, poetic license is not telling us anything really about what clouds are made of. just telling us that, that God has a vast provenience to cover the earth at will, and, you know, he can do what he wants in terms of traveling. So, again, that's something, again, not to overread. Another example of that is Psalm 148, verse 6. I've got the verse for that on an overhead that we can look at. And this is a situation here where all of creation is to praise the Lord. And so we see in verse 3, verse 2, it says, praise him, all his angels, praise him, all his hosts, praise him, sun and moon, praise him, stars of light, and so on. And a person could probably overread this and say, see, sun and moon are being personified here. They're supposed to praise him forever. And therefore, again, they're being viewed as people rather than just inert balls of gas or chunks of rock. Again, this is personification. Poets have been doing this for thousands of years. It's not a big issue because the contrast here is between personification and deification. And the best way to see that is to compare the Bible to other literature of the time and see what's being done. What I've got on the next overhead is a hymn to the sun god that comes from Akkadian literature. And we can, again, see the contrast between viewing an object in this, in a metaphorical sense as a person and viewing an object as a god to worship. This is the Shamash hymn, the sun god. And, for example, in line 128 says, every single person is entrusted to your hands. You arrange their omens, is the word here. It's better, destiny would be the way I would translate it. You manage their destinies, that which is perplexing you make plain. You observe Shamash prayer, supplication, and benediction, obeisance, kneeling, ritual murmurs, and prostration. Again, the feeble man calls to you from the hollow of his mouth. He, his family is remote, his city is distant, calls to you. 146, they confront you, Shamash, and you hear all. So again, in the ancient Near East, they're going beyond personification, they're going to deification, viewing the sun as a god, and worshiping him as such. So again, the contrast between poetic license and deification is quite vast in a person's worldview. Okay. Let's jump into some evidence here, and I've broken it into two categories. One being evidence that's internal to the scriptures, scientific statements or science-related statements that are made to that we can look at. Again, what we're looking for here is the area of compatibility to modern science, and secondly, a contrast with what we would find in other cultures of the time that show the scripture's uniqueness. Again, one area that makes these somewhat hard to work with is that the Bible's the only ancient text that people read. You know, people don't sit around reading Shamash hymns in the New York Times for their spare reading. We don't read a lot of other ancient literature to see this contrast between the biblical worldview and that of other cultures of the time. So we want to take a look at some of these to see some of the contrast. The first area is that of genetics. Again, the scriptural view on genetics and that from other cultures. And this is nicely seen strictly within the Bible. If we look at Genesis 30, that's a nice case in point. I've got the verse for that as well that we can look at. This is the situation of Jacob and Laban, where Jacob's been working for his brother-in-law for a few years and being ripped off by being paid minimum wage. So they negotiate a deal here where Jacob is to take the spotted and speckled sheep and goats that are in Laban's flock for his own wages. That's usually a reasonably low percentage of the animals, so it looks like a good deal to Laban. So verse 34, he says, good, that's what we'll do. So if it's a nice white sheep, Laban gets to keep it. If it's spotted or something, then Jacob gets to keep it. So Jacob pulls out his knowledge of genetics and says, okay, here's what we're going to do. Whenever the sheep are mating, I'm going to bring out these rods of sticks of poplar and almond trees and peel strips off of the bark and put these in front of the animals when they're mating, and that will determine the color of the sheep. Okay, so he's going to load the dice, as you will, in this genetic stuff to get a lot of striped and spotted animals out of them. This is a methodology that was common in genetics even up to a couple hundred years ago. A person with a hair lip, it was felt that even in Western culture that the reason the person got that was the cleft palate was because their mother had looked at a rabbit while they were pregnant, when she was pregnant. So this whole idea that what you see affects what your prodigy are going to look like, it's been a common view for several thousand years. So this was Jacob's understanding of genetics. And see in verse 41 here that it seemed to be working pretty well, because whenever the stronger the flock were mating, again, he's trying to load the dice, he would show them these sticks that had the bark peeled off of them, and lo and behold, the flock were coming out spotted and speckled, and Jacob was getting them. So he was becoming exceedingly prosperous by loading the mating process so that they would bring forth speckled and spotted prodigy. Now, a lot of liberal commentators have looked at this and said, here's a classic case where the science in the Bible is wrong, okay, because, they're portraying this as working, and, we obviously know it doesn't. Problem is liberal commentators don't read the Bible to go on to the next chapter. In Genesis 31, we get God's explanation of what he's doing. See, Jacob thinks that he's loading it using the contemporary scientific knowledge of his time to breed the sheep his way. But then he gets a dream in the night from God. And God says, well, that it came about when the flock were mating, I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream that behold, the male goats that were mating were striped, speckled, and mottled. Now that's God's view of genetics, and that happens to be the correct one. But, it's the genes of the male and the female combined together that give you the different colorations, and has nothing to do with what the sheep are seeing at the time that they're mating or pregnant. And again, he repeats it again just so that we can get the point. Again, God says to Jacob, look, lift up your eyes and see that all the male goats that are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled, because I've seen all that Laban's done to you. So, again, this is an interesting case where God is correcting the science of the patriarchs and saying, well, you think you're controlling it with your rods. I'm the one who is, in effect, juggling the genetics so that what's really happening is it's the animals that are mating are the modeled ones to give you the majority of Laban's flock. So again, that's a science scripture issue where within the text itself, you can see the contemporary view, and you can see God correcting Jacob with the correct genetic viewpoint. So that's a good one where again we can see the compatibility and the uniqueness issues as well. Another area to look at in this regard, again, science internal to the scripture, is that of astronomy. And here there's several verses and points that we can look at. One of them is the scriptural vantage point of the size of the universe. Jeremiah 31:37 is a verse that I'm sure a lot of us are aware of. You can put that up. Again, God's speaking here in the context of a promise to Israel. He says that the heavens above can be measured, the foundations of the earth searched out below. Then I also will cast off all the offspring of Israel for all that they've done. So again, God is staking the size of the universe, if you will, on a promise regarding Israel. And again, here we need to contrast this with other worldviews. The common worldviews of the time, and even prevalent in Western culture, shown on the next overhead, a fairly famous wood cutting that probably people have seen, but the common viewpoint at the time was that the Earth was a solid dome. The sky overhead was a solid dome, and therefore the size of the universe was quite finite. The stars were secured or hung from this solid dome overhead. And here we have a fellow who tried to investigate the universe beyond and discovered kind of strange things out there that haven't been observed before. But basically the thought of the time was that the universe was quite finite. There were a couple of Greeks who felt that the universe might be infinite, but that's at a later time that we have their writings. But again, God's not really saying that the universe is infinite. He's saying that you can't measure it. There's a difference between that standpoint as well. And that agrees with the modern cosmological theory that, again, the universe is not infinite. You can't measure it. And those whole concepts are a vast amount beyond the universe being finite with the dome overhead and the distance between the Earth to the Sun being basically the measure of the size of the universe. Another point that we see in astronomy and also a contrast as well is that regarding the shape of the Earth and the support for the Earth. We get comments here in Job 26 that are very unusual with respect to what we see in other writings from the time. Job 26:7, where Job comments about God, that he stretches out the north over empty space and he hangs the earth on nothing. The contemporary view of the time is that the earth had a solid support underneath it. And in the Hindu literature, you can read that the earth was supported on the backs of the turtles. Again, the whole idea that the earth would be supported on nothing finds no real parallel in other literature of the period. The shape of the earth as well, he's inscribed a circle on the surface of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. The geometry involved in that picture, that the sunlight shining on the earth would cast a circular shape on an object, is consistent with the earth being spherical. Now, it's something that you observe with the moon, with the various crescent shapes of the moon, but again, to say that that's how the light from the sun falls on the earth is, again, quite a leap in what people would say the sunlight was shining on the earth from other cultures. Again, sundown in other cultures was viewed as either the sun going behind a giant mountain, and therefore we didn't see it, or the sun somehow going down into a lake of black mud. That's the Quran's interpretation of sundown. So, again, these vantage points that we see in Job about how the earth is supported and what the contrast, what sundown looks like when viewed from space, that it would look like a crescent across the surface of the earth, are unique vantage points that happen to agree with what we know about celestial mechanics and how the solar system works today. There is some subjectivity in this. An example in verse 11 there, you see the phrase pillars of heaven being used. He inscribed a circle on the surface of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. The next verse is the pillars of heaven tremble and are amazed at his rebuke. So again, this is a poetic passage, and some people fight over some of these phrases in Job. I myself think that they're reasonable, and how I would address the phrasing pillars of heaven is that Job is referring to the clouds at this point. Some people would say, well, the pillars of heaven, again, are going to a viewpoint where the sky overhead is supported by solid columns of stone or metal or something to that viewpoint. I would say, unfortunately, this is a phrase that only occurs once in the Old Testament. Right here, the pillars of heaven refers to clouds. You can see that in Exodus, where when the people are leaving Egypt, that the God goes before them in a pillar of cloud by day and in a pillar of fire by night is the phraseology used. And I think that's the phraseology being carried over here in Job. Well, again, let's take a look at some of the vantage points that other cultures and religions have for the universe overhead. What I looked at here are some examples from the Quran. A very nice one is, I think I've got the overhead for that, is Surah 22 from the Quran. And the Quran's written about 700 A.D., okay, well after the influence of the Greeks and things like that. Down here at the bottom is the example that I'm looking at. This is a contemporary translation, so where I'm not looking at something translated in the 1700s. Contemporary translation of the Quran, Surah 22, the pilgrimage, where it refers to God saying, "Do you not see that God has harnessed all that's in the earth to your service, that the boats ply in the ocean by his command, that he holds the sky in position lest it should fall upon the earth, save by his dispensation. Verily God is compassionate and kind to men." The viewpoint here is that the earth is a solid dome of some form, or at least it's something extremely rigid that has to be held up lest it fall to the earth. Because, well, what is the earth, what is the sky? The sky is gas that is being held up by its weight, and so it's already supporting it. It's already being supported by its own weight and gas pressure. So the viewpoint here in the Quran is that God's compassionate, and his example of that is that he's holding up the solid dome overhead of the sky lest it fall on mankind. Well, that's quite a different vantage point. You know, compare that to Jeremiah 31, where God's compassionate to Israel is related to the fact that the universe cannot be measured. Okay, there's proper science in one standpoint. Here, God's compassionate in the Quran is linked to the fact that he's holding a solid dome overhead so it doesn't collapse. Again, I'm not so sure I want to trust the God of the Quran to be compassionate, if that's the analogy that's being used. A couple of other examples from the Quran are Surah 34, verse 9, where it quite explicitly says that God's compassionate in not dropping a fragment of the sky upon them. Okay, again, the sky is being viewed of as a solid dome overhead, the Chicken Little model, I guess, if you will, where God doesn't drop a fragment of the sky on them, showing his compassionate nature. Another example from the Quran in Surah 67, and this one is brought out in Campbell's book, which you should take a look at, The Quran in the Light of Science. Very excellent book, because people have used the science in the Quran as a proof that the Quran is inspired, and Campbell takes a look at that and says, no, really the science there is very weak and inaccurate, and cites this is an example where we here, as Allah speaking, in the plural, we have adorned the sky with lamps and made them missiles against the devils. And the view here is that the meteors that we see overhead are rocks or are lights, lamps, it's not really specified what they are, that God is throwing at demons who have tried to sneak into the heavens. When a demon tries to sneak into heaven, so God throws a lamp at it, and that's what we see as a meteor. Again, is this the way that God interacts with the demons? That he throws a material object at them in order to keep them from getting into the sky? Again, the worldview, the view of science, the view of the way the heavens run, expressed in the Quran here, is quite a bit different than what we see in modern science. And again, that's the contrast that in using science for apologetics, we need to compare what we see in other books and in other worldviews with what we see in the Bible to really see the contrast between contemporary thought or here thoughts from about 700 AD to what we find in the scriptures. Another area of internal evidence that I think is a very strong one for us to use is the whole area of medicine and hygiene. some of the medical comments that we find in the Old Testament especially. The classic book on the subject is Macmillan's None of These Diseases. It's come out in an original edition was back in the 60s, and it's come out in a second edition. Very excellent book. And if you don't have it, you should really add it to your library of apologetic material to have, both for your own reading and for, you know, using with other people. The major points from Macmillan here, to give an overview, are these aspects. The idea of quarantine, of isolating people who have an illness to prevent it from infecting the whole community. The whole idea that diseases were contagious finds no parallel in other literature of the period. It was generally felt that you got sick because a demon had decided to go after you, and therefore, you know, why should this person be isolated? Because we know where the demon is. He's in the person there. He's not in me. So the whole idea of isolating an individual who's ill to prevent the spread of a disease is very unique. Example of this is in Leviticus 13 verse 4 here, for example, where again, we're to view a person who has an illness as unclean. This is a skin infection. The idea is, as well as a leprosy or whatever is it. Again, if the priest who's checking the person out is not sure what the person has, then he's to isolate him, verse 4, for 7 days, and then take a look after 7 days. If he's still not sure, keep him isolated for another 7 days until you're sure what exactly the disease is. If it clears up, then he can wash his clothes and be clean. If it does turn into leprosy, then you're to treat him as if he has leprosy. So again, the whole idea of isolating a person from a community becomes down with something that you're not sure of to prevent its spread throughout, you know, to other people. The whole idea of diseases being contagious is, again, found in scripture and is not found in other cultures and other medical knowledge at the time. That's reflected in sanitation as well, where again, what are you supposed to do if you need to relieve yourself? You're supposed to go to a place and cover your waist and go to a place outside the camp. Again, the whole idea that fecal matter is a vector for spreading disease and contagious disease, you should not have it around in the areas that you're living. It's again a fairly unique view in the culture of the time, and is quite clearly there in the scriptures. I mentioned it before with regard to Leviticus 13, the whole idea of washing. When you come in contact with a dead body, when you come in contact with something that's unclean, to wash, wait till sundown before joining the community again. Again, the idea of quarantine, isolation, doing things to prevent the spread of a disease, again, are very unique in the idea of medicine in the ancient Near East. The issue of circumcision. Circumcision was prevalent in Egypt and some other cultures, but the timing of it is quite unique. It turns out that on the eighth day after birth, the clotting factors in your blood reach a maximum that occurs at no other time in your life. Between 8 to 10 days, the vitamin K and some of the prothrombin and other factors that clot in your blood peak. And if you're going to have an operation, that's the best day to have it, is on your eighth day. And that's what Abraham commands, that's what God commands Abraham to do in circumcising, is do it on the eighth day of the boy's life. And if you'd done it before then, there's a risk of too severe bleeding. If you do it after then, there's various factors. But the best day to do it in terms of clotting time for the blood and recovery from the cut is on the eighth day. And that's been fairly well documented, and Macmillan spends a chapter on that. The effect is subtle enough that you'd have to do several hundred thousand people before you would see statistically that that's the best time to do it. So it's not intuitively obvious to the casual culture that's circumcising people, but it is an effect that's there that you can see by studying the blood and the clouding factors involved. So again, it's one of those things that's like, well, how did Abraham happen to get that right? No other culture does it at that time. How did he happen to get that right? Well, God told him. Okay, so again, the uniqueness of what we find there. Another point in the medical area, it's a whole area of psychological well-being. And I've got a couple of overheads here that again, Macmillan spends a lot of time on this, and in my early days I used to think, man, this is kind of strange to be doing this. But as one gets older and faces stress in life, you see that really is something that the scriptures give us a lot on how to deal with stress, how to handle problems in life, that, again, other cultures and so on might have other methods. But that in the Bible is pretty good. Medical science is finally kind of confirming. God says, don't let the sun go down on your anger. Well, that contributes to our overall well-being by following the precepts in Scripture. Another overhead from Science News is, again, that marital tiffs spark immune swoon. And the whole idea that your psychological state can cause a drop in your immune system, and you can get sick as a result of it. And the secular world offers solutions through hypnosis and other methods. And yet, the scriptures say, like as I said before, don't let the sun go down on your wrath, and various other what seem to us as Christians common sense principles to deal with things. And yet, there's some medical healthfulness coming in behind them as well. So that's just sort of an aside. If you're reading Macmillan and you see he spends half the book on the psychological side of life, that's because as a doctor, he's seen that 90% of the medical problems that you deal with are psychologically based. So he's responding to that. Okay, let's take a look at some of the medical practices of other cultures here just to piece things together. I've got a Hittite ritual here that we can take a look at just to see how things were dealt with at other times. This is from Pritchard's ancient Near Eastern texts that relate to the Bible that's up in the seminary shelves if you want to see more of these. But these are the examples of things that would be done. The sorceress takes a cord and strings it from the sacrificer's feet to their heads on either side. She also strings it down their back, and she takes it off and places it on a tray of reeds and says, loosen the evil tension of his head, his hands and his feet. Give it to their wicked adversaries. But to the sacrificers, give life, vigor, and long years. So this is a set of rituals that a sorceress would do, speaking to the demon that has invaded the person, saying, bug off, go elsewhere, please. Please infect the enemies rather than the people that are paying me to make it go away. She'll take a piece of fur cloth in the same manner and say, just as the dressers scrape the cloth and clear the tufts away so that it becomes white, so let the gods clear away this man's evil sickness from his body. So again, this was the ancient Near Eastern approach to handling disease, is to, again, try to convince the demon that they should go elsewhere, to use analogy and pictures or sacrifices or whatever to try to get them to leave the person alone. Let's take a look at another text in that regard. This is an ancient Near Eastern cuneiform text that I took a look at. This one's been published in the College of Physicians book. It's kind of a nice one because it really shows an illustration of what's going on. This I put this up so that if you thought your handwriting was chicken scratch, you haven't really seen the real thing. This is cuneiform Akkadian, and again, the signs here are basically word signs or consonant signs that allow us to be able to read what's going on. I'm starting up in verse 29 or 19 up there, and I will give you the English translation so you can follow along a little better. But it's a very similar thing. This is a handbook of prescription for a doctor to use. says, if the man's temples were attacked by the grip of a ghost, now we're not too sure what that disease is, but it was referred to in that term, then you should crush and sift together 10 shekel quantities of each of the following, cedar, cypress, there's a break in the text there, suadu, don't know what that is, ukranu, don't know what that is, boxwood, paluku, sumalu, these are various woods. That's about all we can piece together from this. Various woods they were supposed to take. 13 different kinds here, I believe it is. Some dry beer ingredients, chickpeas, lentil. Knead it in beer and then rub it on leather, perhaps rub it on the person's skin. Not sure of that. With 10 shekels of barley flour, dissolve it in emmer flour in the costume juice. Not sure what that is. Shave his head, bandage his temples, and then anoint him repeatedly with it. And the good advice is that he will live from whatever this affliction is. So that's a 10-line instructions for what we should do. Now, under the Clinton health plan, we won't be able to afford things like that, and this anticipatory text takes that into account because they have a one-liner that basically was if the patient couldn't afford the real expensive treatment, you'd give him this. It's broken up enough that we can't be sure what it was, but it's all something in and have him drink it in a beer mixture and he'll live. So again, for the poor class patients, we had a simpler thing to do in their case. But if you had to really impress the guy, and he had the money, you could do a nice 10-line cure for him. So this is medical practices in the ancient Near East. What's nice in this section of the text is that if those first two don't work, okay, and the guy's really sick, well then what do you do? And this is shown in lines 30 to 33. It says, if the temple seizure continues and the ghost won't go out of the man despite the bandage and the ointment that you've just done, well, then what do you do? Okay, well, you kill a captured goose and take its blood and windpipe, gullet and fat, and the skin of its gizzard, char it, mix them with cedar sap, and recite an incantation 3 times. And he doesn't say he will live, okay? Yeah, he's a little more circumspect about the cure at this point. But again, as has been said in medical encyclopedia, there's nothing from the ancient Near East that is valid medicine that we find anywhere outside of the scriptures. That it's all this sort of thing. You know, you mix a bunch of stuff together and you put it on him and hopefully he'll live. If not, you do an incantation and hopefully that'll work. There's also, for New Age people, there's all kinds of nice things out there, amulets and things like this. In this text, there's also one of those, a ritual where you string together 13 different types of colored stone on a thread of red wool, and you bind that around his head, make a necklace around his head, and that will stop his hair from falling out. Now, if that were a cure for balding, that would be really incredible. But again, you see, a lot of these, it's amazing how Satan has his tactics. You know, the New Age stuff comes back in 3,000 years or 5,000 years. The use of stones because of their magical powers and things like that. We see in Babylonian medical texts. And again, as has been well recognized, the stuff on medicine that we have from other cultures is there's no modern medical significance at all in it. And the quotation on that would be from an Encyclopedia of Medical History. So again, the contrast between the medical and hygiene practices that we have in the scriptures and what we find in contemporary cultures is very vast in that regard. Move on to another area, again, internal evidence. Last one in this category that we'll take a look at is the area of agriculture. And just to point out, and Kearney does this in Evidence for Faith, that the idea of a sabbatical year where you would plant crops for 6 but then let your fields go for a 7th year is a very valuable way to limit crop disease. That if you have a fungal infection or something like that that's getting into your crops, while letting your fields go for a year out of every 7, that gives a good possibility of killing off the fungus that's been invading your wheat field or something over that time. And Kearney spent some time discussing that as well. I have an overhead on that just to show you the passage, where again, God says, 6 years you shall sow your field, 6 years, you'll prune your vineyard and gather its crop. But during the seventh year, you're to give the land a rest. And again, that's helpful in curbing the large-scale spread of plant diseases, because that seventh-year time where you're not growing a large crop, you're just letting whatever come up of itself that gives a chance for the lack of having a large amount of crop there for the disease to grow in, gives it a chance for the disease to be beat back naturally. So that's, again, a technique of agriculture that's in the scriptures that's scientifically solid, that is, again, not something that is found in other cultures around. Okay. Let me just quickly wade through a couple of points here about some problems with internal evidence that we can run into. One of these involves historical baggage, what I call it, from traditional wording that we find in translations of the Bible. Probably the biggest one in this area is terms used with respect to the sky and the whole idea of the firmament. Older translations of the Bible in Genesis 1 will refer to the firmament. What they're doing there is they're following the Latin Vulgate, which is following the Greek Septuagint, which is translating the Hebrew word rakia, the word for sky in Hebrew. And when they made the Septuagint, apparently they followed the Greek mentality of viewing the sky as a solid dome, and that's what ended up into the Latin firmamentum, which came into the English. And again, that has a connotation of solid sky with it. If you look at the Hebrew, the original Hebrew rakia, that does not have the connotation of solid built into it. It has the idea of an expanse rather than the idea of a solid object. So here's something where, again, translations made at the time of the New Testament and so on by contemporary people were translating the Bible in the science of that period, and they got something incorrect in their translation, and that's then stuck with us over a couple thousand years since. So that's one problem when we go to internal evidence, is to watch for some of the wording that's there. The biggest problem is this in this regard. But if you look at Waltke's Hebrew word book and things like that, you'll see a discussion of this where, again, they show that the best translation of rakia, to get back to the original Hebrew, is the idea of an expanse, not the idea of a solid dome or something to that standpoint. Another problem here, and I did touch on this before, is, again, the poetic wording that we will sometimes see and fitting that in. The classic example of that is the whole geocentric notion that people have deduced from the Bible, that the earth is the center of the universe, the earth does not move or turn, and the Bible tells us this. Psalm 96:10 is the good example of that. I went to speak at a conference on geocentricity. It was kind of interesting, taking the opposing view. They were very gracious, but I got honed on some of their arguments. This, for example, would be one of the verses that they would use. Psalm 96:10, where it says, "Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Indeed, the world is firmly established. It will not be moved. And then he will judge the peoples with equity." Well, again, since the foundations of the earth cannot be moved, this implies that, you know, we have a geocentric universe and everything, therefore, must move around the earth. This gets back to Galileo and some of the debates that were kicking around at his time. The question is what's he talking about there when he's referring to the foundations of the earth? In the context, he's saying the world is firmly established, it will not be moved, he will judge the peoples with equity. So he's referring to the world being firmly established in the sense of judgment. He's talking about justice in this context. And that's where I would say what's in view here in terms of the earth not moving is the world order or the system of justice that God has established. A parallel passage in that sense is when the wicked say, "I shall not be moved. God's not going to judge me, I shall not be moved." Psalm 10:6 is a good parallel verse where this same phrasing is used. So what's the idea here? Does this mean that wicked people can't walk, cannot physically be moved? Or does it mean that God's not going to judge them? So, again, that's something that we need to take into account, is watching for poetic wording that was misconstrued to have a scientific context, and then is something we need to go back and reevaluate. Another way of handling the foundation's problem is to say, when that phrase comes up, is, well, what is the foundation of the earth? We're thinking of it physically rather than in a sense of justice. It's that which supports the land masses underneath us. And the foundations of the earth are rather solid rock, or we're on a core of mantle that is reasonably solid. And again, it does not tell us what the earth itself is supported on. We see in Job 26 that it says, you know, God has hung the earth on nothing, but the land masses are supported from underneath with solid objects as well. So we can piece it together and explain the verses from that standpoint as well, and stay within a fairly scientifically credible way of handling that. But this science internal to the scriptures does have a subjective element to it. So we do need to, in grabbing verses and saying, okay, here's where the science in the scriptures is correct, we do need to look very carefully at the translation that we're giving it. We do need to evaluate criticism that we get back from people about, well, really, was that a valid way to be taking the passage? And again, the best way I like to use this material is in contrast to the contemporary culture, as I was doing with the medical material, for example, and say, here's where the Bible is quite unique. And not just go in and grab a verse and run with it, as we saw with, you know, the stars, the morning stars singing for joy at the creation or something. If we use this wisely, I think it's a very powerful evidence, but it can be something that can be misused. We need to be careful with in using it. Okay, let's take a look at another major category, and I'll cover this in 15 minutes, which will be a feat in itself. But again, this is an overview of evidence that's external to the Bible that we can use in witnessing with people, again, to show that there is some reason to conclude that there may be a creator out there based on what we see in the physical universe. And this area is really, I guess, the major focus of IBRI, so there's a lot of material I can refer you to here, so I'll try to cover it fairly quickly. The question here is, again, what do we observe in the physical universe that would imply to us that there is a creator? First point I would have under this is that the universe appears to be created. And this is where astronomy has been having a shake-up in recent times. Again, and here's where the ancient worldviews have a contrast as well, that the universe is not eternal, either into the past or into the future, in that the universe appears to have been created at a distinct point in time, Genesis 1:1, Romans 1:20. That's been there for centuries in the Bible. And astronomers are finally, with the Big Bang Theory, kind of getting around to that conclusion that, yeah, it looks like things have not been here forever. Furthermore, that it looks like things are running down. The hydrogen that's running the stars is being used up. The energy available to give us light and to give us heat, is those energy sources are being consumed in the universe. And therefore, again, the universe is not going to continue on forever as well. Psalm 102 is an excellent verse on that regard, where the psalmist says, of old thou didst form the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. Even they will perish, but thou will endure. All of them will wear out like a garment. Thy clothing you will change, and they will be changed. So the whole idea that the created universe, the physical universe, is running down, is wearing out, that picture of the creation is, again, unique in the ancient Near East. In the ancient Near East, that's good. Ancient Near East. And is here in the scriptures and yet is scientifically bound. That's getting into the laws of thermodynamics and the fact that things are basically, the energy is being used up that's available to heat things, keep things going. So, again, the fact that we live in a created universe should imply to a person trained in science that there is an origin to it, that we have a creator that we need to deal with. Another major area of science external to the Bible gets into life and living systems. There's several areas here that are of value to be pointing out to a person. One of these is the basic information, the amount of information that's necessary to make a living being. Take the simple bacteria or something from that standpoint. The amount of information in the bacteria that's necessary for it to replicate itself is on the order of gigabytes of data. And to say that that amount of information just sort of arose by chance out of some random system is, again, stretching the capability of luck and chance to the limit. The good book on this is Thaxton, Bradley, and Olson's text, which we happen to have here. Again, and I would refer you to that for basically the whole information argument. You can blast over that overhead to go with that. So again, the amount of information necessary in life to keep life going that's in the DNA of the simplest cell is just a lot more than what people could really say could have gotten there by chance. This gets into the origin of life issue, but that is a stumbling block for people in evolutionary theory. How can you get that much information in there, in a cell, over the course of even billions of years to have that amount of information there? That ties into this information content idea, ties into an area that I discuss in my scientific problems of evolution, the basic complexity. We can go to number three. The basic complexity in the engineering of living systems. This information shows up in the complexity of organelles and cellular systems. And this is something that biology has been running into as well. An example of this is in the plain old and simple bacteria. Example that I like to use. The bacteria have been around for a couple billion years, and the way that they get themselves from one location to another is with flagella. They're little hair-like things that come out of the surface of the bacteria, and they use them like a propeller to move to a richer area of food, to come in contact with each other, to exchange DNA and things like that. And one would say, okay, this is a little system that's quite necessary for them to survive. How does it work? And in the mid-70s, they finally got the electron microscopy and experiments figured out well enough to figure out how these things work. And they're basically associated with the flagella is the only rotary motor that's been found to naturally occur in nature. These hairs spin just like a propeller does. It's the spinning that propels the bacteria forward and backward. If they spin in one direction, the hairs come together and propel the bacteria forward. If it spins in the opposite direction, the hairs on the back kind of fly apart and the bacteria tumbles, and that's how it directs itself to head off in another direction. So it's either spinning one way, going forward, spinning the opposite direction, and tumbling to pick a new direction and head off in. Well, okay, let's sit back and think in a purely natural sense. How would this thing have evolved in the first place? I have a little difficulty with that, trying to imagine how something like this would initially develop from randomness. But let's say we want to improve this. We have some basic crude rotary motor here, and we want to improve it by making it stronger. Well, this system works by having can you pull this down a little bit so I can reach it better? Ah, there we go. Okay. has a motor part up here, the stationary part. So this is the armature, the rotor of the motor. Yeah, the armature is the stationary part here. There's a shaft and a bearing and a universal joint that couples the torque made from the rotating motor out to the hair. All of these are different proteins and subunits tied together. We want to make this stronger and more powerful. Well, in order to make it more powerful, you need to make a larger shaft so it can carry the torque better. Well, the mechanism for mutation, for change in evolution is this whole idea of mutation, where one amino acid gets changed at a time, or maybe two get changed at a time, in a cell, in a protein, and that's what this tiny changes of one thing occurring at a time are what give you the improvement that we see going on in life. So we will change this one amino acid at a time and see what happens. So I have my shaft protein here. My goal is to make a stronger motor, so I need to make the shaft a larger diameter. So I make this protein bigger, and wham, it now sticks in the hole and doesn't turn because I've made it larger. I've changed one thing, and now the whole system doesn't work. So I say, well, I can't change that protein first. What I'll do is I'll change the size of the hole that's there first, and then change the shaft at a later mutation in 1,000 years or something like that. So I make the hole bigger, which the shaft goes into. Well, now that hole is big enough that all the guts of the cell leak out because the shaft isn't there, isn't big enough to plug the hole. So the animal dies because the shaft is too big. The hole is too big. So you get this system where you can't imagine a scheme by which you could change it small steps at a time to improve it more or to even bring it about in the first place. And this is a problem that from the secular side has been really recognized. It is one of the stymies of the evolutionary theory in that it's difficult to imagine the mechanisms involved that are taking place in developing some of the complex systems that we see. The big problem in that, again, is this continuous improvement methodology that is part of Darwinian evolution. That it's tiny stepwise changes in the animal, in its proteins, occurring over time. Every one of those improvements, every one of those changes must be an improvement to the animal that gives it an advantage over its companions so that it survives and its companions don't, and it goes on. And it's difficult to see in now that we have a greater and greater understanding of the complexity of living animals, it's harder and harder to see how some of those improvements can be taking place with this tiny stepwise change. By the way, while I'm thinking of evolution, the biggest problem with evolution here, from my standpoint, is the macroevolutionary standpoint. This is the big changes that we see going on. There's, in technical discussions, they will distinguish between microevolution, which are very tiny changes in the coloration of the animal or something to that effect, and macroevolution, which are these big changes of the fish turning into a frog, which then turns into a reptile, which turns into, you know, us or something like that. The macroevolution is where the weaknesses are in the system. The macroevolution is where it's just difficult to imagine the mechanism to make the transition between the various forms that we see. Okay. Then the next point in science in this arena really boils down to the whole area of the origin of life. Quotation on this that I think is excellent and very honest to see is Francis Crick in Life Himself, in his book Life Itself, makes the comment that an honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, can only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to have been satisfied to get it going. And this is really where the origin of life issue has kind of boiled back down to. If you get Time magazine, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, they had a very excellent article on the origin of life issue, which was kind of interesting because if you read the article, it's kind of an admission of the severity of the problem that they have to get life going. It's presented in a very positive note. We've got some incredible new evidence that RNA can replicate itself, and that's how we get life going. But yet, implicit in the article and stated several times is that all of the work that's been done up to the field up to that point has not given anybody any good evidence or clues for how it could work. So it's a nice summary of Perry's talk, saying that, you know, the amino acid origin and so on is a bunch of garbage. So they're sort of like grabbing the latest straw that they've got and saying that all the work done up to that point has not been valuable. So if you look at it from the standpoint of the problems that they bring up in the issue of Origin of Life, the Time magazine article is really excellent from that standpoint. So again, how did life get going? Do people have a mechanism to explain how it could get going? Again, Francis Crick, it really looks like it was a miracle to get things going. Sometimes the best way to summarize an argument is with a cartoon. And I like Sidney Harris's statement here on the Origin of Life, that you can really give, you know, a lot of times we think, I've heard said, if we give scientists billions of years, then they can get life going. You can give scientists hundreds of billions of years, and you couldn't get it going. That, you know, 3.5 billion years ago, a couple of amino acids drift together. 6 seconds later, they drift apart. And then another 0.5 billion years later, they decide to get together again. Again, to get life spontaneously generating itself, to get that amount of complexity that you need, even in the simplest system that people can conceive of, is really, as Crick says, virtually a miracle to get the conditions necessary to have that happen. Finally, another point, and this is a good methodology, I think, to be using. Hugh Ross, in his group Reasons to Believe, is making good use, I think, of the anthropic principle. And the basic concept here is that if we study the physical constants, things like the speed of light, the nature of matter, as well as just things that we observe about the size of the Earth and the way the solar system is set up, it really looks like it's been sculptured or designed or tuned in some sense to support life. And Bob Newman has a talk on this as well where he goes through some of these things. Again, Hugh Ross, if you're not on his mailing list, you should be on it because he has a quarterly newsletter where he looks at this in some detail. And again, the point here is there's been some recent computer modeling done on the size of Jupiter to observe that it's very unusual in solar system origins to have a planet of the size of Jupiter out there. It either goes to be a binary star system, which is fairly common, or to a bunch of small rocky things. And the observation is that in order to clean up the solar system well enough that the inner planets won't be hit by comets every million years or so, or 100,000 years or so, you need to have a big planet out there to be the vacuum cleaner that's cleaning up the debris in the outer solar system to keep it from raining in on the inner planets. And that's what, in effect, Jupiter is doing. And it's unusual to see that configuration in a planetary system. And this is, again, some recent computer modeling done on the secular side with a surprising result that, again, points in the direction of the idea that things look like it's pretty fine-tuned from just the physical universe to support life here on Earth and in general. This idea is found in, again, running around on the secular side, physics texts that I use, Gene Colley, rather secular individual, as far as I know anyhow, college physics textbook, the last paragraph of the book where he deals with a little bit of cosmology, he says, one aspect that's especially intriguing is this. The calculations on the formation and evolution of the universe have been performed that deliberately varied the values, each of things like the speed of light and other constants, just slightly. A fundamental physical constants. The result? the universe in which life as we know it could not exist. This has given rise to the so-called anthropic principle, which says if the universe were even a little bit different than what it is, we couldn't be here. It's as if the universe were exquisitely tuned, almost as if to accommodate us. This is a secular, you know, textbook, just sort of saying, by the way, you know, if you really look at how the universe looks like it's made, the fact that we're here is really unusual. And again, from the Christian side, you'd say, yeah, maybe that implies that there's a creator out there who had us in mind when he started making the physical universe. So what can we say in summary here? A couple minutes just to close. To kind of piece things together and to emphasize the big things in what I've been looking at. Again, remember the contrast feature to, especially with internal evidence and with a lot of the external stuff, the contrast from the biblical material to the other contemporary culture is enormous. And that's something we need to keep in mind and can make the apologetic task a little bit more difficult for us because most people aren't reading ancient Canaanite texts and things like that to see the difference. But that's something we need to keep in mind in looking at it. When you're bringing science into the apologetic battlefield, I would stay with the best points. I think the medical and the hygiene ones are quite solid. And again, in secular sources, it's well recognized that the ancient Hebrews had the only really good, solid medical practices of other cultures that have been studied. The astrophysics standpoint, the complexity of life features that we see are, I think, very good points to be bringing up to people in the scientific arena saying, look, I think there's evidence out there that there's a God that we need to be concerned about. Our goal, again, is to show that belief is reasonable, that it's intellectually credible to hold to not the God of the Bible. And what I would say, and this is kind of an interesting general summary, is that I think based on our scientific knowledge, it's more reasonable to believe the Bible now than at any other time in history. What I mean by that is that there's always been a clash between human thought and the human idea of how the universe was made and constructed and what's been there in the Bible. And there's still a clash in some areas now, but I think there's less clash now. You know, now we realize that it's very clear that the universe was created. Where back 50 years ago, people felt that, no, the sun's always been there. The universe has been eternal. You go back to medieval times and see the clash between medical practices and what's there in the scripture. There was a huge clash back at that time. Back in the Roman world, the Jews were kind of considered to be atheists because they didn't hold to all these other gods that were there controlling nature. They had one transcendent God controlling nature. So the clash between contemporary human thought and what's there in the Bible is decreasing over time and has entered the scientific arena as well. Then, too, just as a summary, we need to remember that we need to be prepared with reasonable answers for other problems that people will have. Often scientific problems are brought up and they're genuine, but there's other problems that the person will have as well. You remember talking with one person about creation and God's involvement with that, and he said, well, I could see that God would be involved, but it must have had to have been just way back at the Big Bang and everything's been running itself since because of the existence of evil. So he saw that. He was Jewish and the Holocaust was a big issue to him. So again, that the whole existence of evil and some of the other problems that we come up with as well can be part of the baggage and roadblocks that this person has to accepting God and accepting Christ. So those are various issues that we have to be aware of as well. It's a hard area to go through in 1 hour. There's books and books and books written on this, and my goal here was to give you an overview and to point you in the directions of where I feel the best resources are to back yourself up with. Thank you.